My name is Mildred, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I'm from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. I have a home group. My home group is the Rocks Glen Traditional Group. We meet Monday and Thursday nights. And if you should happen to be coming to Toronto, please get my phone number. Don't write it on the washroom walls. Just take it. Phone me when you get to Toronto, and I'll be happy to take you to a meeting or see to it that somebody does and make you welcome in our city the way you've made me welcome. In addition to having a home group and in addition to having a dry date, I also have a sponsor. And I use that sponsor, and I sponsor other people. So there you know all the statistics that are relevant. So now we can get on with the business of the evening meeting. Right?
Right.
We've had a few jokes. It just reminds me of a story. I swear I'll never tell jokes up here. But it just reminded me of a little story. This teacher had been teaching the students the story of the prodigal son. And when she was finished, she was curious to know what they had absorbed. So she said, "What do you think he did to waste his money?" And one little boy put up his hand and he said, "I know." He said he spent some of it on wine, he spent some of it on women, and he wasted the rest. So, I first of all would like to thank Craig for inviting me on behalf of the committee. I want to thank you for your kindness here. You're really wonderful to be with, very open and friendly. I want to thank Jen for the effort she has made to be a good hostess, and she has been just the best. And I'd like to thank that firecracker of a signer. You know, on Friday night when we had our first talk, I started listening to Joe, and something attracted me to looking at her, and I think I heard only about half of Joe's talk because I was so fascinated with this. Thank you, Ron, for being a great voice of the conference, and I want to thank the other speakers. It's been wonderful to be here with all of you and hear you. And so that brings me then to what I'm here to do, to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. It also says in the book that we share with one another our stories of how we came to a relationship with God, or words to that effect. And I think really those two mesh really very strongly in my story, because I tried to fix my life. I tried to arrange my life and make it the way I wanted, and it just didn't work. I tried to force people to make my life the way I want it to be. And that was even worse than trying to make it myself. And then, through the things that happened, which I'm going to talk to you about now, life has changed, and I have a totally different quality of life. And I'm very grateful to be here and to give you the gift of my story, as you have given so generously to me over the weekend. I came roaring into Alcoholics Anonymous in November of 1966, and I was excited. You know, you'll say, well, does she belong in a mental institution? I've been there many times. I was excited for a reason. I was in trouble, and I was in big trouble. And a psychiatrist said, "We think that you should go to AA." Now, what did I know about Alcoholics Anonymous? I left home in 1950 to go to a convent, and when I was leaving, my father said, "Make sure you say goodbye to your brother, because you will not see him alive again." Nobody knew what was really wrong with him. They said it was all kinds of things. And then, 2 years later, I get a call from my dad. And he said, "Mildred," and he started to cry. He said, "There's been a miracle in our family. Your brother doesn't drink anymore." He said, "That's what was wrong with him." He said, "He has been transformed. That was the word my father used. I had never heard him use an impressive word like that. He said, and he works. Very good sign with my dad. And he went on to explain that there was this new thing on the prairies. He said, I don't know what it is really about, but he said, it's so good. And he cried. He said, they call it Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's what I knew. And I knew that my brother had done something called 12-step work with wet alcoholics in a hospital room in our hometown. And so that's the information that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with. Did I need this program? Well, I sure needed something. And obviously the rest of the world knew that too, because by that time I had been locked up in mental institutions, psychiatric wards, and insane asylums 32 times. I'm safe. You don't need to run. Since I came here, I haven't been locked up. I think that's a message in itself. They diagnosed me with probably most of the illnesses that are in the psychiatric roster at that time. At one time, they gave me 38 shock treatments. And I can tell you, if you need your life lit up, that'll do it. And I have to tell you, when I sat in line waiting for those shock treatments, I remember thinking, I sure hope they don't tell me I'd rather do this than have to deal with it if they asked me to stop drinking. And when you would rather take a shock treatment than stop drinking, I think you have a tad of a problem. They used to tie me to the bed, and it wasn't with Good Time Charlie. They'd a little slow there. They used to put me in the cold water baths because I'd become violent sometimes. When I was cold sober, I didn't have the nerve to become violent. But when I was drunk, sometimes I'd become violent, and they'd put me in these ice-cold baths until I calmed down. And some of you may know what that process is about. I had spent 15 years in a convent, and that didn't do the job. And I had married my psychiatrist. A really smart move, I'll tell you. He too was alcoholic. Anyway, those are some of the events of my life that tell you who I was or how I was, what had happened to me by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1966. Did I want AA? Yes, I wanted to be fixed. And I thought all I had to do was park my hiney. I didn't know what you had to do. I thought, I'll go to AA, they'll fix me. My father will say, oh, she's transformed, and everything will be wonderful. Well, that was my plan. That isn't the way it worked out. See, I had some more drinking left in me, and I'll talk about that chronologically, I think. I came here, what the book says, in a state of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I come from a good family. I would say that the middle name for my family should be integrity. And then there was me and my brother. I've spent 15 years in a convent. I had every opportunity to live a moral, ethical, happy, whatever kind of life, and I couldn't pull it off. So I came here in a state of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I was what the book says, badly mangled. And people just shook their heads, as they walked away from me. What was wrong with me? Well, I'm not insane much. My recollection of waking up to consciousness on the planet is that I'm crying. And I'm in bed with my sister. I had a sister who was injured at birth, and this is many years ago, and so she couldn't learn as fast as the others. And so they kept her in grade 3 till she was 16. The kids in the neighborhood, her name was Dorothy, they called her Dumb Dora, and that was the way life was. What I didn't know was that my family were good to her. What I tried to do was to stop her crying. She'd cry at night, and she'd crawl into bed with me, and she'd say, "Why was I ever born?" See, lessons to be learned. She never read a book. She never learned to sign her own name. And yet, she went from that kind of victimhood to happiness, to healing. And as one of my Jesuit friends said to me one time when I was telling him this, he said, "You're really thick, you know that?" He said, "You think God needs a big intellect to heal a soul." Not so. You see, she lived her life, she started life fighting life, and she wound up surrendered to what life really was. So, I tried to get my brothers and sisters to fix that. I was the youngest of the family, and my brothers and sisters were all fairly a lot older than I was. And they didn't fix it. See, I was a child in an age when there was no Dr. Phil. I was a child in an age when families didn't talk about stuff. You know, I can't ever remember our family talking about this. So I was left with my own conclusions. This is bad, Dora's crying, you should fix it, and you didn't fix it. And my conclusion was, I guess I'm not important. You don't listen to me. Nobody cares. The world is cruel. That's the way I grew up. That was what was going on inside me. See? Now, that was not the truth, and I want you to be sure that I say that. There was another player in this picture, and that was God. I was raised Roman Catholic. We went to church. And what I heard was this: God is love, and God is power. I've got my answer. All I have to do is tell God what the problem is, give him his marching orders. He's going to fix Dora. Dora's going to be happy. I'm going to be happy. And everything will be just beautiful. Right? Wrong. Nothing happened. And can't say I turned against God. I just became confused. God was like a useless twit to me. Like, what of use are you anyway if you've got all the power and you're loving and you don't help a person like me when we need help? The other thing was, at 5, I took a drink. And I'm not one of those people who slipped into alcoholism. I was like the dried alcoholic waiting for the alcohol to be added. Because when I had that happen to me, I was on a completely different path. And don't tell me a 5-year-old can't be an alcoholic. From that day to the day I sobered up when I was 40, 35 years, that was my total preoccupation. Because when that drink went into me, all difficulty ceased. You know, Sandy said it so well this morning when he said, we become part of. I was no longer isolated. I was no longer confused. I was no longer fearful and unhappy. Everything evened out. I knew that you loved me. I knew that I loved you. I felt wonderful. And that's all that I really wanted, was that wonderful feeling, because when I drank, I came out of the cage. See, I remember my brother when I was a little girl. He was two people. If I smelled booze on him, he danced, he sang, he talked, he gave me money, and all kinds of nice things happened. If there was no booze on him, he sat there and said nothing. He was involved with himself. He was, you know, just as I was. Had nothing to say, totally self-conscious. And so I drank whenever I could. I learned to steal, I learned to lie, I learned to cheat. My father made home brew, and that's how I got that first drink. I didn't know what alcohol did, except I knew one thing. Alcohol did not create havoc in our home, except my brother. Because when people in my home drank, they loosened up. We were rather a stiff, uptight family. And when the booze came out, people laughed much more easily. They told jokes. I liked life when people drank. So one night when my father brought out the homebrew and he had his friends in to play cards, they thought it was very cute. Mildred poured the drinks, and Mildred decided to pour one into herself, and that's when that magic happened. And that's what I chased for the next 35 years. I chased lots of other stuff, but I chased the other stuff because I wanted that feeling. You see, one solution for all problems, that was me, drink. And if you can just get the booze into you, you'll be fine. You know, if it were the right solution, you'd have a different speaker today. I don't think it's the right solution because I think that what was wrong with me, I was out of harmony with life. I was fighting life. I was fighting God. You know, I didn't know who I was despite the fact that I went to church. And I think, therefore, I always felt I didn't fit. I didn't belong. Something was wrong with me. Nobody loves me. I that's the way I lived. And so when I drank, all that went away. But it's the wrong solution. Because I think that feeling, I'm not okay, nobody loves me, all that, that's the fire alarm. That's the warning that says you're out of harmony. You've got to get right with God. But I didn't know that then. And so I used the solution that worked instantaneously for me. I was a weird little kid. Does that surprise you? I was a weird little kid because I lived in my own world. And I didn't fit. But one thing I could always count on, and that was my wits. I was smart. And so I always shone. If it was schoolwork, if it was books, if it was singing, if it was dancing, if it was acting, I shone. And that's the way I got through school. That's the way I got through high school. You know, and the interesting thing that I have learned about myself is I always thought people didn't like me. I always thought that I didn't fit. That's not true. I think they did like me, but I couldn't let it in because I was behind the walls. And it didn't matter how much you told me you liked me and appreciated me and whatever. I couldn't let it in. And so I finished high school when I was 15. And I couldn't get into university. And anyway, I was scared. You know, I don't look like a person who's scared of life. And I can tell you, I spent most of my life afraid of life and making the kinds of decisions that wouldn't put me at risk. See, I learned that in childhood. Life isn't safe. When you got a problem, people don't help you. And so I wanted to be a lawyer, God help me. But I was scared to branch out into the big world and go to university. And anyway, I felt I had to take care of Dora. And at 18, I got another plan. See, and I'm drinking steadily as much as I can. And I decided to go to a convent. And I could spend the whole night telling you stories about that deal. An alcoholic in a convent. There's a story. I was drunk the night I entered. You know, in those days, we didn't have fly by airplane, so I lived in Saskatchewan, so they sent, guess who they sent with me to take me to Hamilton, Ontario, which is like a 3-day train ride? My alcoholic brother. He filled his suitcase with booze. I filled mine with booze, and we had a great trip. The problem was we got to Hamilton, and I was so drunk I could hardly walk. And so he packed me off with my trunk and me and left me at the convent. And they took me. You know, and it's not my imagination. The other sisters who were there, they still remember that night many, many years ago. And they took me in that night and gave me the habit, and so began my illustrious career there. How do you get along in a convent when you're an alcoholic? With a little difficulty, but it's manageable. And I must say, in those 15 years, I never really wanted for booze. Parishioners brought me booze. Priests brought me booze. Friends brought me booze. And what I didn't get that way, I stole. I mean, mass wine has a pretty good kick to it. And I always made sure that I had all the jobs in the church. And should it happen that I drank too much, I'd sleep it off in the confessional. And sometimes Mother Superior would say to me, "Where were you?" "Oh, I was around." The truth of the matter was nobody thought to look for me there. Anyway, I was there for 15 years. And, in those 15 years, nobody ever talked to me about alcoholism. Nobody ever talked to me about my drinking. And it's amazing what you can get away with when you work. I was a star there. You know, I had a 300-voice choir, and I directed operettas, and I taught school, and I had choirs in the church, and I played the organ, and God knows what I was doing. And so nobody said anything to me till one day Mother Superior called me, and she said, she had been watching me, and she said, "Sister, I don't think you're happy here." Well, who's happy, for God's sake? She said, "Would you like to leave?" I said, "Well, you know, and if you understand what I was taught, that if God gave you a vocation and you left that vocation behind, that's what I was taught, you could endanger your immortal soul. And when hell is what you have been taught, this is a big decision." So, anyway, I thought I might as well take the chance, and out I went. I remember standing on the convent steps January the 10th, 1966. I was a well-ed, you know, the sisters were, the convent was good to me. I don't have any problem with the church or the convent or whatever. You know, and if I ever did, I've learned here that if I'm disturbed, I'm the one in error. You know, if there's stuff wrong in my life, I have to look to home and leave, you know, let other people do their thing. I was a well-educated young woman, and I didn't know the first thing about life. I did not know that I was the problem. I stood on that on the convent steps, and I honest to God believed that some man was going to find me. Many did. But one was going to find me, and he was going to be my solution. And we were, you know, life changes are not as simple as changing your name. I was no longer Sister Mary Eugenia. I no longer wore the black and white habit. I no longer had vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Had just fooled around with them a little bit as the times needed. Anyway. And, you know, all that outside stuff had changed. I need to remember that today. It's not about changing the outside. First and foremost, the inside has to be changed. Because I believe that every problem I have ever had has been a spiritual crisis first. And then it manifests on the outside. Anyway, the next 10 months, I'm out of the convent 3 weeks and I'm in jail. You like that picture, do you? I remember looking at those bars saying, "How did this happen?" You're not looking from the outside in. You're looking from the inside out. You're the one in jail. And I like to think of the next 10 months as a landslide to hell. You know, I needed to drink. And I found the drink. I found it in the liquor stores and drank alone, but I also found it in the bars. And there I found the men, and there I found the degradation. And I slid from a place that I can't even begin to describe to a place at the bottom of the pit, where I became the lower companion. And that was 10 months in the making, so that some of those people at the bars, they didn't want a thing to do with me. And finally, I signed myself into 999 Queen Street, which was Ontario's insane asylum. And I thought, I'm bad. You know, there's something drastically wrong with me. And my brother found me there after 2 weeks, and I didn't want to leave. You know, when you don't want to leave a mental an insane asylum, there's something really wrong. Anyway, he took me back to the west, which is where my home was in Saskatchewan. He took me back to Saskatoon, and never underestimate the power of God. Never underestimate the action of God, because I was to meet my destiny there. I was to meet my destiny there in the man who was to become my husband, and I was to meet my destiny there in the person of Dr. Abraham Hoffer, who was the man who had done research on using LSD with schizophrenics. That was before LSD hit the streets and he was put out of business. But in the meantime, I must tell you, he was just in Toronto about 2 months ago receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Orthomolecular Society of maybe North America, but certainly of Canada. Because, anyway, my doctor, you know, my file was thick with all these diagnoses, etc. He went to my doctor and he said, you know, we've misdiagnosed her. You see, he had been with Bill Wilson. He knew about AA. And he said, she's an alcoholic. She should go to AA. And good Dr. McCarrick said, oh, goodness, he said, we couldn't allow that. It would interfere with her treatment. But Dr. Hoffer had enough clout, and that's when I went to AA in November of 1966. And it was beautiful for 3 weeks. That's about as long as it took for me to realize nothing has changed. One more time. See, I changed from being in the convent to being out of the convent. That didn't fix the inside. Now, I'm going to AA, and I've got this head full of theology and philosophy I know about God. So when you talk God and you talk spirituality, I shut you out. I know. And it took about 3 weeks for me to realize that I was still in big trouble sitting at those meetings. I'm inventive. I know there are other substances on the planet that can alter the way you feel. And I certainly could not stand the way I felt, so I didn't want to leave AA. My papa had said, you go to AA, you get transformed. I wanted to be transformed. So I'm going to stay in AA, but I'm going to do it my way. It just interferes a teensy-weensy bit with what you hear and how you do things when you sit there stoned every day. And, you know, I was in Prince Albert at the time. Cease was my first sponsor. There were no women sober there for a period of time, and Cease Cargill took me on and he sponsored me. Chuck Chamberlain used to come out, and Chuck used to try and talk sense to me. Wes Parrish used to come to Prince Albert. You know, what I'm saying is, some of these beautiful people who really understood the program, they did their best to talk sense to me. But you know, that business of surrendering, conceding to our innermost selves, it's a God deal. No human power can bring that about. Because If they could have, Mac Cheater was still alive then. And they did what they could. I sat in AA reading the book, doing externally, you know, doing what they told me to do. Cease even let me go out to the women's jail. He said later on, I carried the mess, not the message. And after 5.5 years of that, I left AA, thinking, this isn't helping me. You're not doing your job. You should have fixed me, you know, all that stuff. And I left Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I'd be all right. In 3 days, I was drunk. I had broken my foot and created all kinds of havoc. And I was to drink for 1.5 years. I'd married that psychiatrist. He, too, was sober. When I met him, he drank again. And it was 1.5 years of disaster. And in 1.5 years, we lost everything. And I mean everything. There was no nice little money socked away somewhere in Switzerland or a little inheritance here. There was nothing by the time we got done. The houses were gone, the cars were gone, and so was the lifestyle. And here you have two amazingly well-educated people, and they have nothing. And it was at this point, I went to a park bench. I spent the last 3 weeks before I got sober on a park bench. I don't look like somebody who lives on a park bench, but I can assure you I know how to do it. I was there. And I woke up in a psych ward. Oh, and, you know, I should say, I could take you through a whole series of stories about blackouts, waking up in strange places with very strange people, having done some very strange things, convulsions. I've had 6 convulsions. You don't want 1, I trust you. And if, you know, I couldn't stop. The book says self-knowledge won't do it. I knew I was alcoholic. It says fear won't do it. Willpower won't do it. God knows how many times I quit. It's amazing to me. Anyway, I woke up in a psych ward. There were 2 men sitting at the foot of my bed, and they really were there. And I couldn't move. I was paralyzed from paralyzed by the stuff I'd been taking. And Sunday morning was the 20th, and the nurse took me to the washroom, and I saw myself. Teeth knocked out. This right eye was sticking out of my head. I had a big purple half moon on my face. I weighed 85 pounds. My hair was straggly. Just a raving beauty, you might say. And I said to the nurse, when I saw myself, I said, you know, I've become a woman of the streets, haven't I? And she said, yes, you have. She said, what are you going to do about it? I don't know. But that question stuck in my mind. And when she brought me back from breakfast, I sat there. And I looked at my life. I had nothing. There was nobody to call. You know, you can think, oh, well, you know, family will put up with you, close friends. There's a day where they cannot tolerate. They couldn't tolerate me. And so they used to say, stay away. If you come near us, we'll call the police and have you arrested. And family would have taken me in, but sober. And I couldn't do sober. You see, I was long past those first drinks where I got release and then became dependent. I was now addicted, and I had to drink. And so I was way past all that. And I knew there was only one thing that I really was going to do, and that was I was going to take my life. And I really meant it. I knew how to do it. I hadn't been in the psych ward for a long time for nothing. And so I knew where I was going to go, and I made up my mind. In half an hour, I'm out of here. And I called the nurse and asked her to get my clothes. And she went to get my clothes, and as she left, I can still see, I know the place I was standing. And I had a spiritual experience, and the compulsion to drink was lifted. I was 40 years old. The compulsion to drink had been dogging me for 35 years, and it was gone in a heartbeat. See, I don't think God hears with the ears that man hears with. When I admitted that I couldn't stop, I was allowed to stop. I don't know how that goes. I just know that surrender of the heart takes many forms. And my cry was, I don't know, I can't do this anymore. I'm not going to spend my life on the streets. I'm out of here. And that's when that miracle occurred. And I'm sober now 34 years and a couple of months, and I've never had that back. And I knew it was gone, but I also knew something else. I also knew that I didn't know how to live. It was crystal clear to me that as I looked down the road, it looked black, uninviting. I didn't recognize any of the signposts, and I understood that if I could not change the way I behaved, and if something didn't change, I knew I was free. I didn't have to drink. But I also knew that I couldn't pull it off unless I changed. And I remember saying, whatever you are, I don't know how to live. If you will send me somebody, I will obey whatever they tell me to do. And there was a rap on the door. I swear to you, that happened. And a man stood there. And he said, I saw you at breakfast. He said, you're in trouble, aren't you? I thought to myself, yeah, you're really smart, aren't you? Only I didn't think that kindly. He said, are you an alcoholic? And I said, yes. Do you want to make something of it? And he said, no. He said, I came to help you, if you'll take help. And he talked to me that he said, I said, I'm not going to AA. Those people are phony. They don't help you. He said, you don't have to go to AA. There's a hospital in Toronto. He said, I'll take you there. And he did. I agreed. And he came and got me on Tuesday, and he took me there, and it was the perfect place. You know, I think that's why we tell our stories, isn't it? Because I hear your stories, and I hear what God and how God, I get trust and hope from seeing how things have evolved in your life. And you can hear that in my life because it was the perfect place for me. They didn't push AA and they didn't push God. I don't know what I would have done. Anyway, it was the perfect place. And after 28 days, they gave me a little money so I could find a room, and I found a room on Skid Row. And I was to live on Skid Row for a year. Best time of my life. You know, that sounds like a strange thing to say. But I think, the good life was so far beyond anything I could imagine that I think I lived without desire. I just put one foot ahead of the other. And I just did what was there to do and lived very small. My psychiatrist, not my husband, the other one, he said, get a job. And I really, to this day, don't know what he meant, but I got a job. I got a job sweeping floors. And I was grateful to have that. My husband, he just couldn't get past who he was, what he was, and he really struggled for a while, and that's his story. He died some years ago, but he had some years of a good life eventually. But I was the one that went out and made a few dollars, and I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for the necessity. You know, we have people in my group in Toronto. They come in with several million dollars. I couldn't have done that. I needed the discipline that I needed. And so, do we have to watch you too? Are you as exciting as she is? Six months went by. Didn't go to a meeting, didn't say a prayer, but I stayed clean and sober. I had no compulsion to drink, and I did what I knew how to do. And 6 months went by, and one Sunday morning I was in the institution. I used to go back because I had no friends, so I would go back to the institution to see the counselors there, and I met a man in the corridor, and he said, "You want to come to a meeting with me?" Whoa! No man had invited me for a long time, and I said, "Sure." I didn't know where we were going. We were going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where we were going. And I can't tell you, I don't remember what happened there. The only thing I remember for the next month or two was, I remember thinking, I don't have nice clothes. You know, my hair's a mess, my teeth are still bad, and, you know, stuff like that. And they kept saying, "Keep coming back. We need you." Me? "Keep coming back. We need you." And they made me feel welcome. That's all I remember. And then I fell in love with AA. And then I thought, well, I guess I better get a sponsor. She had blonde hair, gold earrings, and a white suit. Brilliant qualifications for a sponsor. And she taught me one thing that I needed to know. She used to say, "You can get well despite anybody." Because once in a while I'd go into these tirades, you know, my husband, if he got a job, you know, and if he set up a practice, we'd be fine, he could make lots of money. She'd say, "You can get well despite anybody." And I needed that piece of information, or you'd have a different speaker, because January the 1st, I was ironing a shirt. There had been much violence in our home, and it had not been from me. And that morning I decided, as I was ironing, an overwhelming compulsion, I thought, you know, I'm going to take this iron, he'll never expect it, and I'm just going to smash it right into his face. And I heard her voice in my head saying, "You can get well despite anybody, he's not your problem." And I put the iron down, and that's the day I got serious about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to the meeting that night, because there was one. And there were two men at my group, at the group I was going to then. And I told them about this. And they said, "Mildred, you have to do the steps." And by this time, this woman had gotten drunk. And I have no idea. I've looked for her a number of times, have never been able to find her. And they said, "You have to do the steps." And I said, "I haven't got a clue how to do the steps." Great admission from me. And they said, "If you will come early to your meeting, we'll come early to the meeting, and we'll read the book to you, and we'll teach you and tell you what to do, and we'll take you through the steps." And they did, and I did. And, you know, was it a perfect going through the steps? I don't think so, but it was what I was able to do. And as I said yesterday in the workshop, you know, there's a translation from the Hebrew of the name for God, and it goes like this: "I will be with you wherever you are." And where I was where God met me. And I was able to stay in the program. And as I look at that series of steps we did at that time, the gift to me was step 4, because the night before I did my 5, they told me to read over my 4th step to God and to myself, and I did, and the light bulb went on. I was 41 years old at that time, And I had spent my whole life blaming other people for who I was, how I felt, what I did. It was the whole game. And that night, as I sat there, I knew who it was. Me. I don't know about you, but if you've lived like I lived, I couldn't change the world, and I couldn't get you to change it the way I needed it to be. Now what's left? And they said, when I talked to them about it, they said, if you change, your world will change. And they were absolutely right. And it was only later on I was to read in step 10 in the 12 and 12. It is a spiritual axiom that if you are disturbed, you are the one in error. You are the one that has to change. And I don't know about you, but to me, that's good news, because I'm tired of being a victim. I'm tired of having to look to you to see how I'm going to feel. I'm tired of the pain that comes from that, the anger and the resentment that I have carried over the years. Okay, I'm sober now 1 year, and the day after I got my one-year medallion in Toronto, we give medallions at 1 year, I heard this little voice that said, go and look for a teaching job, and I did, and in 3 days I had a teaching job. Totally a God shot, because the last job I'd had, they kicked me out, told me to get off the property in 10 minutes and never to come back or they'd have me arrested. Me. And so here I have a teaching job. And it was really an important part of my recovery, because I had to get out into the world with people who didn't care that I was sober. They didn't care that I was alcoholic. They didn't want to hear my big tales of woe. They wanted me to come into school and do a decent job with the students that I was supposed to teach. And I have to tell you, at the beginning, that stressed me way beyond what I was capable. But I had a couple of things going for me. I had my AA group going for me. I had God's grace going for me. I had some of the people in my group who really helped me. And you know, sometimes I think we forget. They're not just good people in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are good people all over. And there were great people on that staff, a couple of whom really nurtured me and helped me along. And so, you know, in Canada, we get paid very well. And so I got busy, and I was really active in AA. I was sponsoring people. They all got drunk, but I stayed. I did my best with them, but anyway, that's the way it was. And I paid off my debts, and I paid off his debts, because we were getting divorced, and I wanted my name clear. And so that's how I got to 7 years sober. By this time, I have a new sponsor, and it's a man. And I didn't pick him because he was a man. I picked him because he was tough. And I knew, first of all, I didn't like women still a whole lot. The competition, God knows. And but I had listened to this man, and I had seen him in operation. And I asked him if he would sponsor me. And he said, yes, provided you'll come and you'll talk to myself and my wife, and we'll clear that, and that's what we did. And he saved my life, because he didn't give me an inch. He said, there are some things I'm going to ask you to do. And he said, if you do them, you will get well. I'm not going to run your life, but he said, I'm going to help you to live by the principles of the program and teach you those things that I do to stay sober. And he said, if you don't do them, get another sponsor. Because he said, I'm not going to tell you twice. You know, I've seen how he has sponsored other people. And he's a pussycat. With me, he was a tyrant. And after a while, you know, we just, by the way, celebrated his 50 years on Wednesday night. Yeah, fabulous. He taught me some basic things. See, I believe that when I started to drink, I stopped developing emotionally. I developed intellectually and I developed physically, but I didn't develop skills for living. I didn't develop skills for getting along with people. I was always so angry and so full of fear and always controlling and manipulating. I never could, you know, pull off relationships with people. And, you know, he meticulously helped me. And he was ruthless. One time I said to him, I was working in a new field, and I said, you know, I feel incompetent. And he said, that's probably because you are. He said, what would you have to do to get the information that you could do a proper job? And I said, I'd have to go back to university, and I don't want to go. He said, what does what you want have to do with this? He said, if you read your book, it says, we practice these principles in all our affairs. We take the demonstration of this program into our homes and into our workplace. He said, considering the kind of job you're doing, would you want Dora to be in your classroom? And I said, no. Well, then he said, I guess that's it. I said, I've got to go to meetings. I can't go to university. He said, how many meetings, you know, and don't hear me say meetings aren't important. Of course they are. But he said, you can't use that as an excuse for doing a lousy job at work. Get down to the registrar's office and get registered. And I did. And those were the kinds of lessons that he taught me. And then I was sober, as I said, 7 years. And it was as if the wind was on my back. One day, a friend said, you should start buying houses. And I said, I have no money. She said, come over on Saturday night. We'll show you something. To make a long story short, within 8 or 9 days, I had bought my first house. And I was to buy many houses. And it was a time in Toronto where you could make piles of money buying houses, and I made piles of money. And that was an important part of my life, too, because I had never had the responsibility for houses and property and all that kind of stuff, and that was another piece of my development. And one day I sat on my custom-designed furniture, and I wept. Because I knew there was something not right inside. And all the money and all the ability to do first-class things and go where I pleased, etc., wasn't answering this. At 20 years sober, I broke up with a relationship with a man. Actually, I think both of us had left about 10 years earlier, but we stayed together just for the fun of it. Just a ball of fun. 21 years I left my job. And it was at that time that I went into a major depression. You know, if you looked at my life at that time and you saw how I was living and whatever, you would have said she's got the perfect life. There was something not right inside. And one day I said, I can't do this anymore. Everything's okay on the outside. It's not okay on the inside. And I don't know how to make it okay on the inside. I'm out of here. And I had another spiritual experience, and I knew it was going to be all right. And the next morning and many mornings after, I got up and I put one foot ahead of the other, not knowing where the answer was going to come. And one day the phone rang, and it was a Jesuit. And he said, would you like to come and give retreats? I said, you've got to be kidding. I said, I've been excommunicated so often. You don't want me anywhere near the retreat movement. He said, I know who you are. He said, I'm asking you to come and give a retreat. And I went. And my first retreat was to a group of about 65 women. And the morning I finished that retreat, and I'm telling you this because it was a big piece of my life that dropped from me that morning, I started to cry. I started to bawl, if the truth be known. See, I don't cry in front of women. I know how to do a strategic tear in front of a man, if necessary. But I bawled that morning in front of those women, and I had not planned to do that, and I said words that just shocked me. I said, I don't have a friend in the world. I have many acquaintances, but I don't have a friend in the world. And as the walls dropped, it was a big piece of my growth, because when you have walls, you're so lonely. You can't let people in, and you can't get out. And you're in that period, that isolation place that feels like hell. No matter how fancy the house is, no matter how fancy the clothes, and how big the bank account. And that was an amazing experience for me, because that's another time when I really started to grow. And my life has changed drastically since then. You know, it has changed drastically in the relationships I have and my capacity to have relationships, real relationships. And I have to say, my relationship with God has changed. See, I used to look on spirituality. I'm going to go to the convent, and God and I are going to be spiritual so I can deal with you crapheads. That's just not quite the way it works. See, I look at it today that I can only be as close to God as I allow myself to be close to you. And I can only be as close to you as I can be to myself. Because I think, you know, now, Einstein said it, we're all one. The great teacher said it. He said we're all one. It's been on the planet, and I don't think we've been paying attention to it. I always felt separate and isolated. And now I can come here and know that as I look, you and I are one. I'm reading a book now, and it's all about that, you know, and it's all about the scientific discoveries that show that that is indeed the case. What does that mean in terms of my life? It means that if I'm one with you, how I treat you has to change. And I find that that has been such a gift. I used to walk around, I didn't practice the presence of God. People were people, and if I knew you and felt like treating you nice, that was good, and otherwise I wouldn't hurt you, but I'd just walk past you. If I believe today that you and I are one, then it has to change the way I deal with you. You know, as Sandy said this morning, God is here and God is in each of us, and that means something to me today. It also has allowed me to accept something, because I understand how I struggled. You know, if I look at my life, I never set out to hurt people. I never set out to do some of the disgusting things that I did. And if that's the truth about me, I have to believe that's the truth about you. And so it's not my business to judge and criticize you. And I have to tell you that the quality of my life is about as different as day is from night. I not only like people, I know that they like me. They're attracted to kindness. And you know what I was thinking too about us being together here? I forgot to tell you something. I meant to start out with that, but then I got off on the prodigal son, and it's all your fault. I have a monk friend in London, and he's a close personal friend of the Dalai Lama. and they give retreats together and lectures and so on. I had a letter from him not too long ago. And, you know, we've talked about Alcoholics Anonymous from time to time, and I always sensed that he wasn't terribly impressed. And one day I got a letter from him, and he said, "Mildred, you'll never imagine." He said, "I got a request to give some lectures on spirituality as it pertains to addiction." And he said, "I really didn't know it much about that subject." So he said, "I thought I better go to some of those Alcoholics Anonymous meetings." He said, "I'm overwhelmed." And this was his comment. I'm repeating it word for word. He said, "In my opinion," and remember, he's been out, you know, with the Dalai Lama, and they've been doing this and that, and what he said was this: "In my opinion, Alcoholics Anonymous is the most powerful, global, transformative, spiritual program on the planet today." Wow. I said to him, "Maybe you should drink a bit and then you can become one of them." He said, "You know, they tell me I can go to those open meetings." And what he commented, and I thought of that this weekend, he commented on the kindness that he saw, the helpfulness. He said, "What a great group of people you are." And, well, imagine, the most powerful, global, transformative, spiritual experience program on the planet today. Well, as I've told you, you see where I came from. Something powerful surely must have happened to allow me to be at this podium today. Am I fixed? No. Nope. Do I want to be fixed? I don't know. I'm just doing my best to have some good days, to live the best I know how. I got to stand at Dora's bedside and close her eyes in death. You know, that was a big deal. A very big deal. But the big deal about it really was, well, a couple of things. That I knew she had come to peace. I got to spend the last night with her that she was on the planet. And though she was in a coma, I stood by her bedside and I did a life review with her. And talked to her about letting go of any harm or any anger that she might still carry or whatever, and fill her heart with love so that when she went whatever place that other side is, that she was going there with an open heart. And then it was morning, and my brothers and sisters who are still alive, we were 10, we're 4 now. That makes you know the years are passing on. We stood around her bedside, and there's a sister-in-law I have who said to Dora, Dora's mouth was open, she said, "Dora, if you can close your mouth, it'll be easier to breathe." And Dora was about 20 minutes from death, and she did. And then about 5 minutes before Dora died, this happened again, and again Dora responded. This is a sister-in-law that I haven't particularly liked. And one time when I was home, when my mom and dad died, one of my sisters and my brother-in-law took Dora in. They had 5 little kids, and they took her in, and they gave her a home. She was child number 6. And I say to my brother-in-law, "You're an angel." And he says, "Oh, go on with you. We just did what we were supposed to do." Anyway, I was home visiting one time, and my sister was, she's beautiful, calm, soft-spoken, and I said, she was giving a dinner party, and I said, "Who did you invite?" And she told me, and she mentioned the sister-in-law. And I said, "Do we have to have her?" And she, innocent, said, "Why?" I said, "Because I said, she's always so pretentious, and she's always telling you how rich they are and how many powerful friends they have, etc., etc., etc. And my sister, without skipping a beat, said, she only acts that way when you're here. Oh, yes. Watch where it comes from, because there she was at the deathbed. And I got a powerful message, because when I went back to Toronto, I talked to my spiritual director about this. And I was saying, you know, I told him how I'd spent the night with Dora. And I said, I would just love to know that she heard me. And he said, you really are thick, aren't you? I said, what do you mean? Well, he said, if she responded to this person saying, you can close your mouth 20 minutes before she died, he said, don't you think maybe that was God saying, it's okay, Mildred. She heard you last night when you were doing these prayers and songs with her and so on. So, there you go. I think it's about time that I bring this to a close. There's no way, you know, when I look at it, that left to my own devices, I could be standing here. There's no way left to your smarts that I could be standing here. And I believe there's no way left to my smarts that you'd be here. See, I think when we say how wonderful Alcoholics Anonymous is, what we're really giving credit to is the grace of God that comes to us, and we become the channels to one another. We carry that to one another. And that is what I trust I have carried to you tonight. God bless.